in one small pill. Unwrap a stick of chewing gum, and the flour used to keep the gum from sticking may trigger a reaction. Brush your teeth, and you may discover there is flour in the toothpaste. Apply lipstick, and you can inadvertently ingest hydrolyzed wheat protein by licking your lips, followed by throat irritation or abdominal pain. At church, taking the sacrament means a wafer of wheat. For some people, the teensy-weensy quantity of wheat gluten contained in a few breadcrumbs or the gluten-containing hand cream collected under your fingernails is enough to trigger diarrhea and cramps. Being sloppy about gluten avoidance can have dire long-term consequences, such as small intestinal lymphoma. So the celiac sufferer ends up making a nuisance of herself at restaurants, grocery stores, and pharmacies, having to inquire constantly if products are gluten-free. Too often, the minimum-wage sales clerk or overworked pharmacist has no idea. The 19-year-old waitress serving your breaded eggplant usually doesn't know or care what gluten-free is. Friends, neighbors, and family will see you as a fanatic. The celiac sufferer therefore has to navigate the world constantly on the lookout for anything containing wheat or other gluten sources, such as rye and barley. To the dismay of the celiac community, the number of foods and products containing wheat has increased over the past several years, reflective of the lack of appreciation of the severity and frequency of this condition and the growing popularity of healthy whole grains. The celiac community offers several resources to help the celiac sufferer succeed. The Celiac Society, www.celiacsociety.com, provides a listing and search feature for gluten-free foods, restaurants, and manufacturers. The Celiac Disease Foundation, www.celiac.org, is a good resource for emerging science. One danger: some celiac disease organizations obtain revenue from promotion of gluten-free products, a potential diet hazard that, while gluten-free, can act as junk carbohydrates. Nonetheless, much of the resources and information provided by these organizations can be helpful. The Celiac Spru Association, www.csaceliacs.org, the most grassroots effort, is the least commercial. It maintains a listing and organizes regional groups for support. Celiac Disease Light. While celiac disease affects only 1% of the population, two common intestinal conditions affect many more people: irritable bowel syndrome, IBS, and acid reflux, also called reflux esophagitis, when esophageal inflammation is documented. Both may represent lesser forms of celiac disease, what I call celiac disease light. IBS is a poorly understood condition, despite its frequent occurrence. Consisting of cramping, abdominal pain, and diarrhea, or loose stools, alternating with constipation, it affects between 5% and 20% of the population, depending on definition. Think of IBS as a confused intestinal tract, following a disordered script that complicates your schedule. Repeated endoscopies and colonoscopies are typically performed. Because no visible pathology is identified in IBS sufferers, it is not uncommon for the condition to be dismissed or treated with antidepressants. Acid reflux occurs when stomach acid is permitted to climb back up the esophagus due to a lax gastroesophageal sphincter, the circular valve meant to confine acid to the stomach. Because the esophagus is not equipped to tolerate acidic stomach contents, acid in the esophagus does the same thing that acid would do to your car's paint job. It dissolves it. Acid reflux is often experienced as common heartburn, accompanied by a bitter taste in the back of the mouth. There are two general categories of each of these conditions: IBS and acid reflux with positive markers for celiac disease, and IBS and acid reflux without positive markers for celiac disease. People with IBS have a 4% likelihood of testing positive for one or more celiac markers. People with acid reflux have a 10% chance of having positive celiac markers. Conversely, 55% of celiac sufferers have IBS-like symptoms, and between 7 and 19% have acid reflux. Interestingly, 75% of celiac sufferers obtain relief from acid reflux with wheat removal, while non-celiac people who do not eliminate wheat nearly always relapse after a course of acid-suppressing medication but continued gluten consumption. Could it be the wheat? Eliminate wheat, acid reflux improves, symptoms of IBS improve. Unfortunately, this effect has not been quantified, though investigators have speculated on how large a role gluten plays in non-celiac sufferers of IBS and acid reflux. I have personally witnessed complete or partial relief from symptoms of IBS and acid reflux with gluten removal from the diet many hundreds of times, whether or not celiac markers are abnormal. Let celiac disease set you free. Celiac disease is a permanent condition. Even if gluten is eliminated for many years, celiac disease or other forms of immune-mediated gluten intolerance come rushing back on re-exposure. Because susceptibility to celiac disease is, at least partly, genetically determined, it doesn't dissipate with healthy diet, exercise, weight loss, nutritional supplements, drugs, daily enemas, healing stones, or apologies to your mother-in-law. It stays with you as long as you are human and are unable to trade genes with another organism. In other words, you have celiac disease for a lifetime. It means that even occasional casual exposure to gluten has health consequences to the celiac disease sufferer or the gluten-sensitive individual, even if immediate symptoms such as diarrhea are not provoked. All is not lost if you have celiac disease. Food can be every bit as enjoyable without wheat, even more so. One of the essential but unappreciated phenomena accompanying wheat and gluten elimination, celiac or otherwise, you appreciate food more. You eat foods because you require sustenance, and you enjoy their taste and texture. You are not driven by hidden, uncontrollable impulses of the sort triggered by wheat. Don't think of celiac disease as a burden. Think of it as liberation. Chapter 7. Diabetes Nation. Wheat and Insulin Resistance. I've kicked it in the jaw, beaten it, and called it names. Let's now look this thing called diabetes square in the eye. President of the Soup Bone Club. When I was a kid growing up in Lake Hiawatha, New Jersey, my mother used to point to one person or another and declare him or her the president of the Soup Bone Club. That's the title she gave local people who thought they were big shots in our little town of 5,000. One time, for instance, the husband of a friend of hers droned on about how he could fix all the ills of the country if only he were elected president, though he was unemployed, was missing two front teeth, and had been arrested twice for drunk driving over the past 2 years. Thus my mother's gracious appointment of the man as the president of the Soup Bone Club. Wheat, too, is the leader of an unenviable group, the worst carbohydrate in the bunch, the one most likely to lead us down the path of diabetes. Wheat is president of its own little Soup Bone Club, chief among carbohydrates. Drunk, foul-mouthed, and unbathed, still wearing last week's T-shirt, it gets elevated to special fiber-rich, complex carbohydrate, and healthy whole grain status by all the agencies that dispense dietary advice. Because of wheat's incredible capacity to send blood sugar levels straight up, initiate the glucose-insulin roller coaster ride that drives appetite, generate addictive brain-active exorphins, and grow visceral fat, it is the one essential food to eliminate in a serious effort to prevent, reduce, or eliminate diabetes. You could eliminate walnuts or pecans, but you will have no impact on diabetic risk. You could eliminate spinach or cucumbers and have no effect on diabetic risk. You could banish all pork or beef from your table and still have no effect. But you could remove wheat and an entire domino effect of changes develop. Less triggering of blood sugar rises, no exorphins to drive the impulse to consume more, no initiation of the glucose-insulin cycle of appetite. And if there's no glucose-insulin cycle, there's little to drive appetite except genuine physiologic need for sustenance, not overindulgence. If appetite shrinks, calorie intake is reduced, visceral fat disappears, insulin resistance improves, blood sugars fall. Diabetics can become non-diabetics. Pre-diabetics can become non-pre-diabetics. All the phenomena associated with poor glucose metabolism recede, including high blood pressure, inflammatory phenomena, glycation, small LDL particles, triglycerides. In short, remove wheat and thereby reverse a constellation of phenomena that would otherwise result in diabetes and all its associated health consequences, 3 or 4 medications, if not 7, and years shaved off your life. Think about that for a moment. The personal and societal costs of developing diabetes are substantial. On average, one person with diabetes incurs $180,000 to $250,000 in direct and indirect health care costs if diagnosed at age 50 and dies 8 years earlier than someone without diabetes. That's as much as $250,000 and half the time spent watching your children grow up that you sacrifice to this disease, a disease caused in large part by food, in particular, a specific list of foods. President of this soup bone club? Wheat. The clinical data documenting the effects of wheat elimination on diabetes are somewhat blurred by lumping wheat into the larger category of carbohydrates. Typically, health-conscious people who follow conventional dietary advice to reduce fat and eat more healthy whole grains consume approximately 75% of their carbohydrate calories from wheat products. That's more than enough hobnobbing with the soup bone club to take you down the road to the increased medical costs, health complications, and shortened lifespan of diabetes. But it also means that if you knock off the top dog, the pack disperses. Passing water that tastes like honey. Wheat and diabetes are closely interwoven. In many ways, the history of wheat is also the history of diabetes. Where there's wheat, there's diabetes. Where there's diabetes, there's wheat. It's a relationship as cozy as McDonald's and hamburgers. But it wasn't until the modern age that diabetes became not just a disease of the idle rich, but of every level of society. Diabetes has become every man's disease. Diabetes was virtually unknown in the Neolithic age, when Natufians first began to harvest wild einkorn wheat. It was certainly unknown to the Paleolithic age, the millions of years preceding the agricultural ambitions of Neolithic Natufians. The archaeological record and observations of modern hunter-gatherer societies suggest that humans almost never developed diabetes nor died of diabetic complications before grains were present in the diet. The adoption of grains into the human diet was followed by archaeological evidence of increased infections, bone diseases such as osteoporosis, increased infant mortality, and reduction in lifespan, as well as diabetes. For example, the 1534 BC Egyptian Ebers papyrus, discovered in the necropolis of Thebes, and harking back to the period when Egyptians incorporated ancient wheat into their diet, describes the excessive urine production of diabetes. Adult diabetes, type 2, was described by the Indian physician Sushruta in the 5th century BC, who called it marumeya, or honey-like urine, due to its sweet taste. Yes, he diagnosed diabetes by tasting urine, and the way the urine of diabetics attracted ants and flies. Sushruta also presciently ascribed diabetes to obesity and inactivity and advised treatment with exercise. The Greek physician Eretius called this mysterious condition diabetes, meaning passing water like a siphon. Many centuries later, another urine-tasting diagnostician, Dr. Thomas Willis, added mellitus, meaning tasting like honey. Yes, passing water like a siphon that tastes like honey. You'll never look at your diabetic aunt the same way again. Starting in the 1920s, diabetes treatment took a huge leap forward with the administration of insulin, which proved life-saving for diabetic children. Child diabetics experience damage to the insulin-producing beta cells of the pancreas, impairing its ability to make insulin. Unchecked, blood glucose climbs to dangerous levels, acting as a diuretic, causing urinary water loss. Metabolism is impaired, since glucose is unable to enter the body's cells due to lack of insulin. Unless insulin is administered, a condition called diabetic ketoacidosis develops, followed by coma and death. The discovery of insulin earned Canadian physician Sir Frederick Banting the Nobel Prize in 1923, spawning an era in which all diabetics, children and adults, were administered insulin. While the discovery of insulin was truly life-saving for children, it sent the understanding of adult diabetes off course for many decades. After insulin was discovered, the distinction between type 1 and type 2 diabetes remained blurred. It was therefore a surprise in the 50s when it was discovered that adult type 2 diabetics don't lack insulin until advanced phases of the disease. In fact, most adult type 2 diabetics have high quantities of insulin, several times greater than normal. Only in the 80s was the concept of insulin resistance discovered, explaining why abnormally high levels of insulin were present in adult diabetics. Unfortunately, the discovery of insulin resistance failed to enlighten the medical world when the 80s notion of reducing fat and saturated fat in the diet led to a nationwide open season on carbohydrates. In particular, it led to the idea that healthy whole grains would salvage the health of Americans believed to be threatened by overconsumption of fats. It inadvertently led to a 30-year experiment in what can happen to people who reduce fats but replace lost fat calories with healthy whole grains such as wheat. The result? Weight gain, obesity, bulging abdomens of visceral fat, pre-diabetes and diabetes on a scale never before witnessed, affecting males and females alike, rich and poor, herbivores and carnivores, reaching across all races and ages, all passing water like a siphon that tastes like honey. Whole Grain Nation. Adult diabetes through the ages was mostly the domain of the privileged who didn't have to hunt for their food, farm the land, or prepare their own meals. Think Henry VIII, gouty and obese, sporting a 54-inch waistline, gorging nightly on banquets topped off with marzipan, loaves of bread, sweet puddings, and ale. Only during the last half of the 19th century and into the 20th century, when sucrose, table sugar consumption, increased across all societal levels, common laborer on up, did diabetes become more widespread. The transition of the 19th into the 20th century therefore witnessed an increase in diabetes, which then stabilized for many years. For most of the 20th century, the incidence of adult diabetes in the United States remained relatively constant, until the mid-80s. Then, things took an abrupt turn for the worse. Today, diabetes is epidemic, as common as tabloid gossip. In 2009, 24 million Americans were diabetic, a number that represents explosive growth compared to just a few years earlier. The number of Americans with diabetes is growing faster than any other disease condition, with the exception of obesity, if you call obesity a disease. If you're not diabetic yourself, then you likely have friends who are diabetic, co-workers who are diabetic, neighbors who are diabetic. Given the exceptionally high incidence in the elderly, your parents are, or were, likely to be diabetic. And diabetes is just the tip of the iceberg. For every diabetic, there are three or four people with pre-diabetes, encompassing the conditions impaired fasting glucose, impaired glucose tolerance, and metabolic syndrome, waiting in the wings. Depending on whose definition you use, an incredible 22-39% of all U.S. adults have pre-diabetes. The combined total of people with diabetes and pre-diabetes in 2008 was 81 million, or 1 in 3 adults over 18 years of age. That's more than the total number of people, adults and children, diabetic and non-diabetic, living in the entire United States in 1900. If you also count the people who don't yet meet full criteria for pre-diabetes, but just show high after-meal blood sugars, high triglycerides, small LDL particles, and poor responsiveness to insulin, insulin resistance, phenomena that can still lead to heart disease, cataracts, kidney disease, and eventually diabetes, you would find few people in the modern age who are not in this group, children included. This disease is not just about being fat and having to take medications. It leads to serious complications, such as kidney failure. 40% of all kidney failure is caused by diabetes, and limb amputation. More limb amputations are performed for diabetes than any other non-traumatic disease. We're talking real serious. It's a frightening modern phenomenon, the widespread democratization of a formerly uncommon disease. The widely broadcast advice to put a stop to it? Exercise more, snack less, and eat more healthy whole grains. Pancreatic assault and battery. The explosion of diabetes and pre-diabetes has been paralleled by an increase in people who are overweight and obese. Actually, it would be more accurate to say that the explosion of diabetes and pre-diabetes has been in large part caused by the explosion in overweight and obesity, since weight gain leads to impaired insulin sensitivity and greater likelihood that excess visceral fat accumulates, the fundamental conditions required to create diabetes. The fatter Americans become, the greater the number that develop pre-diabetes and diabetes. In 2009, 26.7% of American adults, or 75 million people, met criteria for obesity, that is, a body mass index, BMI, of 30 or greater, with an even greater number falling into the overweight, BMI 25 to 29.9, category. No state has yet met, nor is any approaching, the 15% goal for obesity set by the U.S. Surgeon General's Call to Action to Prevent and Decrease Overweight and Obesity. As a result, the Surgeon General's office has repeatedly emphasized that Americans need to increase their level of physical activity, eat more reduced-fat foods, and yes, increase consumption of whole grains. Weight gain is predictably accompanied by diabetes and prediabetes, though the precise weight point at which they develop can vary from individual to individual, a genetic component of risk. One 5'5" woman might develop diabetes at a weight of 240 pounds, while another 5'5" woman might show diabetes at 140 pounds. Such variation is determined genetically. The economic costs of such trends are staggering. Gaining weight is exceptionally costly, both in terms of healthcare costs and the personal toll on health. Some estimates show that over the next 20 years, an incredible 16 to 18% of all healthcare costs will be consumed by health issues arising from excessive weight, not genetic misfortune, birth defects, psychiatric illness, burns, or post-traumatic stress disorder from the horrors of war. No, just getting fat. The cost of Americans becoming obese dwarfs the sum spent on cancer. More money will be spent on health consequences of obesity than education. Yet another factor parallels the trends in diabetes, prediabetes, and weight gain. You guessed it, wheat consumption. Whether it's for convenience, taste, or in the name of health, Americans have become helpless wheataholics, with per capita annual consumption of wheat products, white and wheat bread, durum pasta, having increased by 26 pounds since 1970. If national wheat consumption is averaged across all Americans, babies, children, teenagers, adults, the elderly, the average American consumes 133 pounds of wheat per year. Note that 133 pounds of wheat flour is equal to approximately 200 loaves of bread, or a bit more than half a loaf of bread per day. Of course, this means that many adults eat far more than that amount, since no baby or young child included in the averaging process eats 133 pounds of wheat per year. That said, babies eat wheat, children eat wheat, teenagers eat wheat, adults eat wheat, the elderly eat wheat. Each group has its own preferred forms: baby food and animal crackers, cookies and peanut butter sandwiches, pizza and Oreos, whole wheat pasta and whole grain bread, dry toast and Ritz crackers. But in the end, it's all the same. In parallel with increased consumption, we also have the silent replacement of wheat from 4-foot-tall Triticum estivum with high-yield dwarf strains and new gluten structures not previously consumed by humans. Physiologically, the relationship of wheat to diabetes makes perfect sense. Products made with wheat dominate our diet and push blood sugar higher than virtually all other foods. This sends measures such as HbA1c, reflecting the average preceding 60 to 90 days blood glucose, higher. The cycle of glucose-insulin reaching high levels several times every day provokes growth of visceral fat. Visceral fat, wheat belly, is closely aligned with resistance to insulin that, in turn, leads to even higher levels of glucose and insulin. The early phase of growing visceral fat and diabetes is accompanied by a 50% increase in pancreatic beta cells responsible for producing insulin, a physiologic adaptation to meet the enormous demands of a body that is resistant to insulin. But beta cell adaptation has limits. High blood sugars, such as those occurring after a nice cranberry muffin consumed on the car ride to work, provoke the phenomenon of glucotoxicity, actual damage to pancreatic insulin-producing beta cells that results from high blood sugars. The higher the blood sugar, the more damage to beta cells. The effect is progressive and starts at a glucose level of 100 milligrams per deciliter, a value many doctors call normal. After two slices of whole wheat bread with low-fat turkey breast, a typical blood glucose would be 140 to 180 milligrams per deciliter in a non-diabetic adult, more than sufficient to do away with a few precious beta cells, which are never replaced. Your poor, vulnerable pancreatic beta cells are also damaged by the process of lipotoxicity, loss of beta cells due to increased triglycerides and fatty acids, such as those developing from repeated carbohydrate ingestion. Recall that a diet weighted toward carbohydrates results in increased VLDL particles and triglycerides that persist in both the after-meal and between-meal periods, conditions that further exacerbate lipotoxic attrition of pancreatic beta cells. Pancreatic injury is further worsened by inflammatory phenomena, such as oxidative injury, leptin, various interleukins, and tumor necrosis factor, all resulting from the visceral fat hotbed of inflammation, all characteristic of pre-diabetic and diabetic states. Over time and repeated sucker punches from glucotoxicity, lipotoxicity, and inflammatory destruction, beta cells wither and die, gradually reducing the number of beta cells to less than 50% of the normal starting number. That's when diabetes is irreversibly established. In short, carbohydrates, especially those such as wheat products that increase blood sugar and insulin most dramatically, initiate a series of metabolic phenomena that ultimately lead to irreversible loss of the pancreas's ability to manufacture insulin, diabetes. Fighting carbohydrates with carbohydrates? A Paleolithic or Neolithic human breakfast might consist of wild fish, reptiles, birds, or other game, not always cooked, leaves, roots, berries, or insects. Today, it will more likely be a bowl of breakfast cereal consisting of wheat flour, cornstarch, oats, high fructose corn syrup, and sucrose. It won't be called wheat flour, cornstarch, oats, high fructose corn syrup, and sucrose, of course, but something more catchy such as crunchy health clusters or fruity munchy squares. Or it might be waffles and pancakes with maple syrup, or a toasted English muffin spread with preserves, or a pumpernickel bagel with low-fat cream cheese. For most Americans, extreme carbohydrate indulgence starts early and continues throughout the day. We shouldn't be one bit shocked that, as our physical lives have become less demanding, when's the last time you skinned an animal, butchered it, chopped wood to last the winter, or washed your loincloth in the river by hand? And rapidly metabolized foods of convenience and indulgence proliferate. Diseases of excess will result. Nobody becomes diabetic by gorging on too much wild boar they've hunted, or wild garlic and wild berries they've gathered, or too many veggie omelets, too much salmon, or too much kale, pepper slices, and cucumber dip. But plenty of people develop diabetes because of too many muffins, bagels, breakfast cereals, pancakes, waffles, pretzels, crackers, cakes, cupcakes, croissants, donuts, and pies. As we've discussed, foods that increase blood sugar the most also cause diabetes. The sequence is simple. Carbohydrates trigger insulin release from the pancreas, causing growth of visceral fat. Visceral fat causes insulin resistance and inflammation. High blood sugars, triglycerides, and fatty acids damage the pancreas. After years of overwork, the pancreas succumbs to the thrashing it has taken from glucotoxicity, lipotoxicity, and inflammation, essentially burning out, leaving a deficiency of insulin and an increase in blood glucose, diabetes. Treatments for diabetes reflect this progression. Medications such as pioglitazone, Actos, to reduce insulin resistance are prescribed in the early phase of diabetes. The drug metformin, also prescribed in the early phase, reduces glucose production by the liver. Once the pancreas is exhausted from years of glucotoxic, lipotoxic, and inflammatory pummeling, it is no longer able to make insulin, and insulin injections are prescribed. Part of the prevailing standard of care to prevent and treat diabetes, a disease caused in large part by carbohydrate consumption, is to advise increased consumption of carbohydrates. Years ago, I used the ADA diet in diabetic patients. Following the carbohydrate intake advice of the ADA, I watched patients gain weight, experience deteriorating blood glucose control, and increased need for medication, and develop diabetic complications such as kidney disease and neuropathy. Just as Ignaz Semmelweis caused the incidence of childbed fever in his practice to nearly vanish just by washing his hands, ignoring ADA diet advice and cutting carbohydrate intake leads to improved blood sugar control, reduced HbA1c, dramatic weight loss, and improvement in all the metabolic messiness of diabetes, such as high blood pressure and triglycerides. The ADA advises diabetics to cut fat, reduce saturated fat, and include 45 to 60 grams of carbohydrate, preferably healthy whole grains, in each meal, or 135 to 180 grams of carbohydrates per day, not including snacks. It is, in essence, a fat-phobic, carbohydrate-centered diet, with 55 to 65% of calories from carbohydrates. If I were to sum up the views of the ADA toward diet, it would be, go ahead and eat sugar and foods that increase blood sugar. Just be sure to adjust your medication to compensate. But while fighting fire with fire may work with pest control and passive-aggressive neighbors, you can't charge your way out of credit card debt, and you can't carbohydrate stuff your way out of diabetes. The ADA exerts heavy influence in crafting national attitudes toward nutrition. When someone is diagnosed with diabetes, they are sent to a diabetes educator or nurse who counsels them in the ADA diet principles. If a patient enters the hospital and has diabetes, the doctor orders an ADA diet. Such dietary guidelines can, in effect, be enacted into health law. I've seen smart diabetes nurses and educators who, coming to understand that carbohydrates cause diabetes, buck ADA advice and counsel patients to curtail carbohydrate consumption. Because such advice flies in the face of ADA guidelines, the medical establishment demonstrates its incredulity by firing these rogue employees. Never underestimate the convictions of the conventional, particularly in medicine. The list of ADA-recommended foods includes whole grain breads, such as whole wheat or rye, whole grain high-fiber cereal, cooked cereal such as oatmeal, grits, hominy, or cream of wheat, rice, pasta, tortillas, cooked beans and peas, such as pinto beans or black-eyed peas, potatoes, green peas, corn, lima beans, sweet potatoes, winter squash, low-fat crackers and snack chips, pretzels, and fat-free popcorn. In short, eat wheat, corn, rice, and wheat. Ask any diabetic about the effects of this diet approach, and they will tell you that any of these foods increase blood sugar up to the 200 to 300 milligram per deciliter range or higher. According to ADA advice, this is just fine, but be sure to track your blood sugars and speak to your doctor about adjustments in insulin or medication. Does the ADA diet contribute to a diabetes cure? There's the gratuitous marketing claim of working toward the cure, but real talk about a cure? In their defense, I don't believe that most of the people behind the ADA are evil. Many, in fact, are devoted to helping fund the effort to discover the cure for childhood diabetes. But I believe they got sidetracked by the low-fat dietary blunder that set the entire United States off course. To this day, the notion of treating diabetes by increasing consumption of the foods that caused the disease in the first place, then managing the blood sugar mess with medications, persists. We have the advantage, of course, of 20/20 hindsight, able to view the effects of this enormous dietary faux pas, like a bad B-movie video on the VCR. Let's rewind the entire grainy, shakily filmed show. Remove carbohydrates, especially those from healthy whole grains, and an entire constellation of modern conditions reverse themselves. Goodbye to wheat. Goodbye to diabetes. Maureen, a 63-year-old mother of three grown children and grandmother to five, came to my office for an opinion regarding her heart disease prevention program. She'd undergone two heart catheterizations and received three stents in the past 2 years, despite taking a cholesterol-reducing statin drug. Maureen's laboratory evaluation included lipoprotein analysis that, in addition to low HDL cholesterol of 39 milligrams per deciliter and high triglycerides of 233 milligrams per deciliter, uncovered an excess of small LDL particles. 85% of all Maureen's LDL particles were classified as small, a severe abnormality. Maureen had also been diagnosed with diabetes 2 years earlier, first identified during one of the hospitalizations. She had received counseling on the restrictions of both the Heart Healthy Diet of the American Heart Association and the American Diabetes Association diet. Her first introduction to diabetes medication was metformin. However, after a few months, she required the addition of one, then another medication, this most recent drug, a twice-a-day injection, to keep her blood sugars in the desired range. Recently, Maureen's doctor had started talking about the possibility of insulin injections. Because the small LDL pattern, along with low HDL and high triglycerides, are closely linked to diabetes, I counseled Maureen on how to apply diet to correct the entire spectrum of abnormalities. The cornerstone of the diet, wheat elimination. Because of the severity of her small LDL pattern and diabetes, I also asked her to further restrict other carbohydrates, especially cornstarch and sugars, as well as oats, beans, rice, and potatoes. This severer restriction is not necessary in most people. Within the first 3 months of starting her diet, Maureen lost 28 pounds off her starting weight of 247. This early weight loss allowed her to stop the twice-daily injection. 3 more months and 16 more pounds gone, and Maureen cut her medication down to the initial metformin. After a year, Maureen had lost a total of 51 pounds, tipping the scale below 200 for the first time in 20 years. Because Maureen's blood glucose values were consistently below 100 milligrams per deciliter, I then asked her to stop the metformin. She maintained the diet, followed by continued gradual weight loss. She maintained blood glucose values comfortably in the non-diabetic range. 1 year, 51 pounds lost, and Maureen said goodbye to diabetes. Provided she doesn't return to her old ways, including plenty of healthy whole grains, she is essentially cured. Deja vu all over again. 5th century BC Indian physician Sushruta prescribed exercise for his obese patients with diabetes at a time when his colleagues looked to omens from nature or the position of the stars to diagnose the afflictions of their patients. 19th century French physician Apollinaire Bouchardat observed that sugar in the urine of his patients diminished during the 4-month-long siege of Paris by the Prussian army in 1870, when food, especially bread, was in short supply. After the siege was over, he mimicked the effect by advising patients to reduce consumption of breads and other starches and to fast intermittently to treat diabetes, despite the practice of other physicians who advised increased consumption of starches. Into the 20th century, the authoritative Principles and Practice of Medicine, authored by Dr. William Osler, iconic medical educator and among the four founders of the Johns Hopkins Hospital, advised a diet for diabetics of 2% carbohydrate. In Dr. Frederick Banting's original 1922 publication, describing his initial experiences injecting pancreatic extract into diabetic children, he notes that the hospital diet, used to help control urinary glucose, was a strict limitation of carbohydrates to 10 grams per day. It may be impossible to divine a cure based on primitive methods such as watching whether flies gather around urine, methods conducted without modern tools such as blood glucose testing and hemoglobin A1C. Had such testing methods been available, I believe that improved diabetic results would indeed have been in evidence. The modern cut-your-fat, eat-more-healthy whole grains era caused us to forget the lessons learned by astute observers such as Osler and Banting. Like many lessons, the notion of carbohydrate restriction to treat diabetes is a lesson that will need to be relearned. I do see a glimmer of light at the end of the tunnel. The concept that diabetes should be regarded as a disease of carbohydrate intolerance is beginning to gain ground in the medical community. Diabetes as a byproduct of carbohydrate intolerance is actively being advocated by vocal physicians and researchers such as Dr. Eric Westman of Duke University, Dr. Mary Vernon, former medical director of the University of Kansas Weight Control Program, and past president of the American Society of Bariatric Physicians, and prolific researcher Dr. Jeff Volek of the University of Connecticut. Doctors Westman and Vernon report, for instance, that they typically need to reduce the insulin dose by 50% the first day a patient engages in reducing carbohydrates to avoid excessively low blood sugars. Dr. Volek and his team have repeatedly demonstrated, in both humans and animals, that sharp reduction in carbohydrates reverses insulin resistance, postprandial distortions, and visceral fat. Several studies conducted over the past decade have demonstrated that reduction in carbohydrates leads to weight loss and improved blood sugars in people with diabetes. In one of these studies, in which carbohydrates were reduced to 30 grams per day, 11.2 pounds of weight loss on average resulted, and HbA1c, reflecting average blood glucose over the preceding 60 to 90 days, was reduced from 7.4 to 6.6% over a year. A Temple University study of obese diabetics showed that reduction of carbohydrates to 21 grams per day led to an average of 3.6 pounds of weight loss over 2 weeks, along with reduction in HbA1c from 7.3 to 6.8% and 75% improvement in insulin responses. Dr. Westman has been successfully validating what many of us learn in clinical practice. Virtual elimination of carbohydrates, including the dominant carbohydrate of so-called healthy diets, wheat, not only improves blood sugar control, but can erase the need for insulin and diabetes medications in adult type 2 diabetics, otherwise known as a cure. In one of Dr. Westman's recent studies, 84 obese diabetics followed a strict low-carbohydrate diet, no wheat, cornstarch, sugars, potatoes, rice, or fruit, reducing carbohydrate intake to 20 grams per day, similar to Drs. Osler and Banting's early 20th century practices. After 6 months, waistlines, representative of visceral fat, were reduced by over 5 inches, triglycerides dropped by 70 milligrams per deciliter, weight dropped 24.5 pounds, and HbA1c was reduced from 8.8 to 7.3%. And 95% of participants were able to reduce diabetes medications, while 25% were able to eliminate medications, including insulin, altogether. In other words, on Dr. Westman's protocol, using nutrition, not drugs, 25% of participants were no longer diabetic, or at least had blood sugar control improved sufficiently to manage with diet only. The remainder, while still diabetic, enjoyed better blood glucose control and reduced need for insulin and other medications. The studies to date have achieved proof of concept. Reduction of carbohydrates improves blood sugar behavior, reducing the diabetic tendency. If taken to extremes, it is possible to eliminate diabetes medications in as little as 6 months. In some instances, I believe it is safe to call that a cure, provided excess carbohydrates don't make their way back into the diet. Let me say that again. If sufficient pancreatic beta cells remain and have not yet been utterly decimated by long-standing glucotoxicity, lipotoxicity, and inflammation, it is entirely possible for some, if not most, pre-diabetics and diabetics to be cured of their condition, something that virtually never happens with conventional low-fat diets such as that advocated by the American Diabetes Association. It also suggests that prevention of diabetes, rather than reversal of diabetes, can be achieved with less intensive dietary efforts. After all, some carbohydrate sources, such as blueberries, raspberries, peaches, and sweet potatoes, provide important nutrients and don't increase blood glucose to the same extent that more obnoxious carbohydrates can. You know who I'm talking about. So what if we follow a program not quite so strict as the Westman Cure Diabetes study, but just eliminated the most ubiquitous diet-dominating blood sugar-increasing food of all? In my experience, you will drop blood sugar and HbA1c, lose visceral fat, wheat belly, and free yourself from the risk of participating in this nationwide epidemic of obesity, pre-diabetes, and diabetes. It would scale back diabetes to pre-1985 levels, restore 1950s dress and pants sizes, even allow you to again sit comfortably on the airline flight next to other normal weight people. Wheat and childhood type 1 diabetes. Prior to the discovery of insulin, childhood or type 1 diabetes was fatal within a few months of onset. Dr. Frederick Banting's discovery of insulin was truly a breakthrough of historic significance. But why do children develop diabetes in the first place? Antibodies to insulin, beta cells, and other self-proteins result in autoimmune destruction of the pancreas. Children with diabetes also develop antibodies to other organs of the body. One study revealed that 24% of children with diabetes had increased levels of autoantibodies, that is, antibodies against self-proteins, compared to 6% in children without diabetes. The incidence of so-called adult type 2 diabetes is increasing in children, due to overweight, obesity, and inactivity, the very same reasons it is skyrocketing in adults. However, the incidence of type 1 diabetes is also increasing. The National Institutes of Health and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention co-sponsored the Search for Diabetes in Youth study, which demonstrated that from 1978 to 2004, the incidence of newly diagnosed type 1 diabetes increased by 2.7% per year. The fastest rate of increase is being seen in children under the age of 4. Disease registries from the interval between 1990 and 1999 in Europe, Asia, and South America show a similar increase. Why would type 1 diabetes be on the increase? Our children are likely being exposed to something. something sets off a broad abnormal immune response in these children. Some authorities have proposed that a viral infection ignites the process, while others have pointed their finger at factors that unmask expression of autoimmune responses in the genetically susceptible. Could it be wheat? The changes in the genetics of wheat since 1960, such as that of high-yielding dwarf strains, could conceivably account for the recent increased incidence of type 1 diabetes. Its appearance coincides with the increase in celiac disease and other diseases. One clear-cut connection stands out. Children with celiac disease are 10 times more likely to develop type 1 diabetes. Children with type 1 diabetes are 10 to 20 times more likely to have antibodies to wheat and/or have celiac disease. The two conditions share fates with much higher likelihood than chance alone would explain. The cozy relationship of type 1 diabetes and celiac disease also increases over time. While some diabetic children show evidence for celiac disease when diabetes is first diagnosed, more will show celiac signs over the ensuing years. A tantalizing question. Can avoidance of wheat starting at birth avert the development of type 1 diabetes? After all, studies in mice genetically susceptible to type 1 diabetes show that elimination of wheat gluten reduces the development of diabetes from 64% to 15% and prevents intestinal damage characteristic of celiac disease. The same study has not been performed in human infants or children, so this crucial question therefore remains unanswered. Though I disagree with many of the policies of the American Diabetes Association, on this point we agree. Children diagnosed with type 1 diabetes should be tested for celiac disease. I would add that they should be retested every few years to determine whether celiac disease develops later in childhood, even adulthood. Although no official agency advises it, I don't believe it would be a stretch to suggest that parents of children with diabetes should strongly consider wheat gluten elimination, along with other gluten sources. Should families with type 1 diabetes in one or more family members avoid wheat from the start of life to avoid triggering the autoimmune effect that leads to this lifetime disease called type 1 diabetes? Nobody knows, but it's a question that truly needs answering. The increasing incidence of the condition is going to make the issue more urgent in the coming years. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. The wheat as guilty culprit in causing obesity and diabetes reminds me of the O.J. Simpson murder trial. Evidence found at the scene of the crime, suspicious behavior by the accused, bloody glove linking murderer to victim, motive, opportunity, but absolved through clever legal sleight of hand. Wheat looks every bit the guilty party in causing diabetes. It increases blood sugar more than nearly all other foods, providing ample opportunity for glucotoxicity, lipotoxicity, and inflammation. It promotes visceral fat accumulation. There is a fits-like-a-glove correlation with weight gain and obesity trends over the past 30 years, yet it has been absolved of all crimes by the dream team of the USDA, the American Diabetes Association, the American Dietetic Association, etc., all of whom agree that wheat should be consumed in generous quantities. I don't believe that even Johnny Cochran could have done any better. Can you say mistrial? In the Court of Human Health, however, you have the opportunity to redress the wrongs by convicting the guilty party and banishing wheat from your life. Chapter 8. Dropping Acid, Wheat as the Great pH Disruptor. The human body is a tightly controlled pH vessel. Veer up or down from the normal pH of 7.4 by just 0.5, and you're dead. The acid-base status of the body is finely tuned and maintains more tightly than the Fed regulates the discount rate. Severe bacterial infections, for instance, can be deadly because the infection yields acid byproducts that overwhelm the body's capacity to neutralize the acid burden. Kidney disease likewise leads to health complications because of the kidney's impaired ability to rid the body of acid byproducts. In daily life, the pH of the body is locked at 7.4, thanks to the elaborate control systems in place. Byproducts of metabolism, such as lactic acid, are acids. Acids drive pH down, triggering a panic mode response from the body to compensate. The body responds by drawing from any alkaline store available, from bicarbonate in the bloodstream to alkaline calcium salts, such as calcium carbonate and calcium phosphate in bones. Because maintaining a normal pH is so crucial, the body will sacrifice bone health to keep pH stable. In the great triage system that is your body, your bones will be turned into mush before pH is allowed to veer off course. When a happy net alkaline balance is struck, bones will be happy, joints will be happy. While pH extremes in either direction are dangerous, the body is happier with a slight alkaline bias. This is subtle and not reflected in blood pH, but evident by such methods as measuring acid and alkaline products in the urine. Acids that stress the body's pH can also come through diet. There are obvious dietary sources of acid, such as carbonated sodas that contain carbonic acid. Some sodas, such as Coca-Cola, also contain phosphoric acid. The extreme acid loads of carbonated sodas stretch your body's acid-neutralizing capacity to its limits. The constant draw on calcium from bones, for instance, is associated with fivefold increased fractures in high school girls who consume the most carbonated colas. But certain foods can be not-so-obvious sources of acids in this tightly controlled pH environment. Regardless of source, the body must buffer the acid challenge. The composition of the diet can determine whether the net effect is an acid challenge or an alkaline challenge. Proteins from animal products are meant to be the main acid-generating challenge in the human diet. Meats such as chicken, pork roast, and Arby's roast beef sandwiches are therefore a major source of acid in the average American diet. Acids yielded by meats, such as uric acid and sulfuric acid, the same as in your car's battery and acid rain, need to be buffered by the body. The fermented product of bovine mammary glands, cheese, is another highly acidic group of foods, particularly reduced-fat, high-protein cheeses. Any food derived from animal sources, in short, generates an acid challenge, whether fresh, fermented, rare, well done, with or without special sauce. However, animal products may not be as harmful to pH balance as it first appears. Recent research suggests that protein-rich meats have other effects that partially negate the acid load. Animal protein exerts a bone-strengthening effect through stimulation of the hormone insulin-like growth factor, IGF-1, which triggers bone growth and mineralization. Insulin-like refers to its similarity in structure to insulin, not similarity in effect. The net effect of proteins from animal sources, despite their acid-generating properties, is that of increasing bone health. Children, adolescents, and the elderly, for instance, who increase protein intake from meat, show increased bone calcium content and improved measures of bone strength. Vegetables and fruits, on the other hand, are the dominant alkaline foods in the diet. Virtually everything in your produce department will drive pH toward the alkaline direction. From kale to kohlrabi, generous consumption of vegetables and fruits serve to neutralize the acidic burden from animal products. Bone breaker. Hunter-gatherer diets of meats, vegetables, and fruits, along with relatively neutral nuts and roots, yield a net alkaline effect. Of course, the struggle for the hunter-gatherer wasn't pH regulation, but dodging the arrows of an invading conqueror or the ravages of gangrene. So perhaps acid-based regulation did not play a major role in the health and longevity of primitive people who rarely survived beyond their 35th birthday. Nonetheless, the nutritional habits of our ancestors set the biochemical stage for modern human adaptation to diet. Around 10,000 years ago, the formerly alkaline human diet pH balance shifted to the acid side with the introduction of grains, especially the most dominant of grains, wheat. The modern human diet of plentiful, healthy whole grains, but lacking in vegetables and fruit, is highly acid-charged, inducing a condition called acidosis. Over years, acidosis takes its toll on your bones. Like the Federal Reserve, bones from skull to coccyx serve as a repository, not of money, but of calcium salts. Calcium, identical to that in rocks and mollusk shells, keeps bones rigid and strong. Calcium salts in bone are in dynamic balance with blood and tissue and provide a ready source of alkalinizing material to counter an acid challenge. But, like money, the supply is not infinite. While we spend our first 18 or so years growing and building bone, we spend the rest of our lives tearing it back down, a process regulated by body pH. The chronic mild metabolic acidosis engendered by our diet worsens as we age, starting in our teens and continuing through the eighth decade. The acidic pH pulls calcium carbonate and calcium phosphate from bone to maintain the body pH of 7.4. The acidic environment also stimulates bone resorbing cells within bones, known as osteoclasts, to work harder and faster to dissolve bone tissue to release the precious calcium. The problem comes when you habitually ingest acids in the diet, then draw on calcium stores over and over and over again to neutralize these acids. Though bones have a lot of stored calcium, the supply is not inexhaustible. Bones will eventually become demineralized, that is, depleted of calcium. That's when osteopenia, mild demineralization, and osteoporosis, severe demineralization, frailty, and fractures develop. Frailty and osteoporosis usually go hand in hand, since bone density and muscle mass parallel each other. Incidentally, taking calcium supplements is no more effective at reversing bone loss than randomly tossing some bags of cement and bricks into your backyard is at building a new patio. An excessively acidified diet will eventually show itself as bone fractures. An impressive analysis of the worldwide incidence of hip fracture demonstrated a striking relationship. The higher the ratio of protein intake from vegetables to the protein intake from animal products, the fewer hip fractures occur. The magnitude of difference was substantial. While a vegetable-to-animal protein intake ratio of 1-to-1 or less was associated with as many as 200 hip fractures per 100,000 population, a vegetable-to-animal protein intake ratio of between 2-to-1 and 5-to-1 was associated with less than 10 hip fractures per 100,000 population, a reduction of more than 95%. At the highest intakes of vegetable protein, the incidence of hip fracture practically vanished. The fractures that result from osteoporosis are not just tumbling down the stairs kinds of fractures. They can also be vertebral fractures from a simple sneeze, a hip fracture from misjudging the sidewalk curb, a forearm fracture from pushing a rolling pin. Modern eating patterns therefore create a chronic acidosis that in turn leads us to osteoporosis, bone fragility, and fractures. At age 50, 53.2% of women can expect to experience a fracture in their future, as can 20.7% of men. Contrast this with a 50-year-old woman's risk for breast cancer of 10% and risk for endometrial cancer of 2.6%. Until recently, osteoporosis was thought to be largely a condition peculiar to postmenopausal females who have lost the bone-preserving effects of estrogen. It is now understood that the decline in bone density begins years before menopause. In the 9,400-participant Canadian multicenter osteoporosis study, females began to show declining bone density in the hip, vertebra, and femur at age 25, with a precipitous decline resulting in accelerated loss at age 40. Men show a less marked decline starting at age 40. Both men and women showed another phase of accelerated bone loss at age 70 and onward. By age 80, 97% of females have osteoporosis. So even youth does not ensure protection from bone loss. In fact, loss of bone strength is the rule over time, largely due to the chronic low-grade acidosis we create with diet. What do acid rain, car batteries, and wheat have in common? Unlike all other foods derived from plants, grains generate acidic byproducts, the only plant products to do so. Because wheat is, by a long stretch, the foremost grain in most Americans' diet, it contributes substantially to the acid burden of a meat-containing diet. Wheat is among the most potent sources of sulfuric acid, yielding more sulfuric acid per gram than any meat. Wheat is surpassed only by oats in quantity of sulfuric acid produced. Sulfuric acid is dangerous stuff. Put it on your hand and it will cause a severe burn. Get it in your eyes and you can go blind. Go take a look at the warnings prominently displayed on your car battery. The sulfuric acid in acid rain erodes stone monuments, kills trees and plants, and disrupts the reproductive behavior of aquatic animals. The sulfuric acid produced by wheat consumption is undoubtedly dilute, but even in teensy-weensy quantities in dilute form, it is an overwhelmingly potent acid that rapidly overcomes the neutralizing effects of alkaline bases. Grains such as wheat account for 38% of the average American's acid load, more than enough to tip the balance into the acid range. Even in a diet limited to 35% of calories from animal products, adding wheat shifts the diet from net alkaline to strongly net acid. One way to gauge acid-induced extraction of calcium from bone is to measure urinary calcium loss. A University of Toronto study examined the effect of increasing gluten consumption from bread on the level of calcium lost in the urine. Increased gluten intake increased urinary calcium loss by an incredible 63%, along with increased markers of bone resorption, that is, blood markers for bone weakening that lead to bone diseases such as osteoporosis. So what happens when you consume a substantial quantity of meat products but fail to counterbalance the acid load with plentiful alkaline plant products such as spinach, cabbage, and green peppers? An acid-heavy situation results. What happens if acids from meat consumption are not counterbalanced by alkaline plants, and the pH scales are tipped even more to the acidity?